Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you are listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is British solo racing skipper Alex Thompson. Alex is a veteran of no less than five editions of the Vendée Globe solo around the world race. He made his first attempt in 2004, but damage to his boat put him out of that race and the following edition in 2008-09. He did go on to finish third in the 2012-13 edition and then second in the 2016-17 race. Despite starting the 2020-21 edition as firm favourite to become the first ever non-French Vendée Globe winner, Alex was again forced out of the race after first having to effect running repairs to the bow of his state-of-the-art ultra-high-tech Imoca 60 and then suffering catastrophic damage to one of his rudders in a collision with floating ocean debris. The British skipper shocked the sailing world recently with the announcement that he would not be competing in the 2024-25 Vendée Globe. Alex Thompson, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. Let's start by telling us where you're speaking to us from today.
I'm currently in Jersey and soon to be going back down to the south of France and pick up my boat and sail out to Lorient with a new owner. So looking forward to that.
With a new owner. So big news, Alex, in recent weeks. I think it's fair to say you kind of shocked the sailing world a little bit with your announcement that you won't be participating in the next Vendée Globe, but there is a chance you might do the one after that. What's behind all this? What's the big news?
Yeah, the main reason for me is that I've got a 10-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl, and since they've been born. Really, I haven't been present very much. You know, the job of competing in the Vendée and all the associated bits to go with it is all encompassing. It never stops, and it takes up every ounce of energy that I have. And I don't feel that I can be a skipper in the Vendée Globe like I have been, and be a good dad and a good husband. So it's an easy decision, really, because my lives of the kids, my kids' lives and my family's life must come before what I love to do.
Yeah, and that makes absolute sense. But easy in that terms, but also must be difficult for you to kind of step away from a race that you've had such a close association with.
A little bit like that. But on the other hand, we intend to be there in 24 with another skipper and another new boat. So it doesn't feel like it's, that far away. It'd just be somebody else that will be doing the hard work in the ocean.
All right. I want to follow up with you on that topic. But before we do that, can we just go back to the time when you became captivated with this sport of sailing? What was your first sailing experience? Can you do the kind of who were you with? Where was it? What were you sailing?
It was windsurfing originally in a place called Brosnaiga, North Wales. I think I was about 11. And it was on a little lake learning to windsurf. So windsurfing was my first introduction to sailing. And then from there, dinghy sailing and then yacht sailing in about 1995, I think, was when I started yacht sailing, maybe 94.
And the dinghy sailing, was it a local club or?
Yeah, I was sailing down at Stokes Bay, International 14s to begin with, and then 505s. And then from there, I got my dinghy instructors, windsurfing instructors, and taught kids out of, it was the Portsmouth Outdoor Centre now. Now it's the Andrew Simpson Centre in Portsmouth. So for after teaching kids for a year, I then thought I'd go and make some real money. And get my yacht master and go and work at a sailing school. So I managed to get an apprenticeship position at Britannia Sailing in about 94, 95.
We hope you're enjoying listening to this edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast. For more exclusive news, views and interviews from the professional sailing world, check out the Yacht Racing Life website at www.yachtracing.life.
So this sounds like it pretty quickly evolved into a career in sailing. But can you remember what it was that first triggered your passion for sailing? Perhaps it was the windsurfing. Perhaps it was when you switched to dinghies.
I think the synergy with offshore sailing came from doing my first fastnet race. I did it with a guy called Kevin Townsend in 95 on a Sigma 36 called British Eagle. I remember it took 8 days to finish the course. And I think as soon as I started sailing out of sight of land and feeling, that feeling that you get a bit like the mountains where everything's so big and you're so tiny, I think that's where it came from, really. And then in 98, Sir Robin Knox-Johnson gave me a job to skipper in the Clipper race. And I said to myself, if I win this race, then I'll carry on and be a professional sailor. And if I don't, then I'll do something else. So luckily enough, my crew were great and we managed to win that race.
Yeah, you did. You were 25 when you did that. I think you were the youngest skipper in the race at that time. So it wasn't a given that you were going to win. Going into that, what was your experience of racing offshore at that point?
I'd just done the previous Fastnet program. So I'd done three offshore races and the Fastnet. And then I'd sailed to Greenland with Sir Robert Knox-Johnson there and back. Got trapped by ice. Had the best adventure of my life. And it was on the boat that I did the race, that ultimately did the race on. So I remember saying to Robin in either late 97 or early 98, Robin said, would you come to Greenland to be my first mate? And I said to Robin, well, Robin, I'm here because I want to do the round the world race as a skipper. But am I too young, Robin? And he said, well, I don't know, Thompson, come to Greenland and we'll find out. So I went to Greenland with Robin and I did my celestial navigation on the way there. There was no sun during the day, so it was all stars, planets and moon. On the back of that, Robin gave me the job to skip around the world. So it happened very quickly. And looking back, Robin took a massive risk to give me a job. I was pretty young and it was a lot of responsibility. But he gave me the job and it really made me.
Yeah, and I mean, what a daunting task to tell, not just to race around the world, but to race around the world with a crew of people that you're responsible for. Did that weigh heavily on you?
Worryingly, no, it didn't. No, it didn't. I mean, to me, it was one of the best things I ever did. I really grew up a lot and very much enjoyed the process. And I was, super lucky. I had a really amazing bunch of people as crew, tried really hard. And, as always, they're the people that do the hard work, and the skipper might take the glory, but I can tell you these guys and girls did the hard work.
Yeah. And these, of course, were people who, weren't professional sailors. They were paid to play, weren't they? They were paid to take part in the race. And I guess for them, they're on a huge adventure too. Did you get a sense of that both you and the crew were part of this amazing adventure?
Yeah, definitely, and everybody does that race for different reasons. My crew, I think we only had in those days four or five that went all the way around the world. And my around the world is, I had a German chap called Heiko, British guy called Tim, had a chap called Richard Horton Fawkes, so blind, and he sailed all the way around the world. He's still one of my best friends. He's more than 80 now. Who else? So we had Marjorie Titterington from up north. She was an amazing lady who looked after us all. And there was another lady called Tessa, I think. So, yeah, it was quite, I think we had maximum 11 people on the boat at any one time and four or five round the worlders. So having a very close group of round the worlders helped a lot. And, as I say, it doesn't really matter what the skipper is like. It's the crew that really makes a difference on those legs.
Yeah, I wondered, Sir Robin Knox-Johnson was a hero of mine growing up. I read his book A World of My Own so many times that the paperback copy just literally fell to bits on me. Was he a hero of yours at that point, or was he somebody that you'd been lucky enough to end up working for?
Yeah, Robin's always been a hero right from the beginning, and you know him giving me a job at the age I was at, and I know there were people that were advising him not to. You know, he gave me a real chance in life, which you know, he could have very easily ended up with egg on his face. So no, he's always a hero. He still is, and I'm seeing him this week actually.
Yeah, did some of the inspiration for wanting to race solo come from him, or how did that evolve after a fully crewed race like the Clipper race?
Well, obviously, I talked to Robin a lot about it, and he's got a lot of amazing stories about his trip around the world. And I think at the time when I finished Clipper, I'd actually flown back from Cape Town to see if I could get a job with Pete Goss and Team Phillips. Went down and had a cup of tea with Pete, which is great. And I didn't get that job, and I remember being very disappointed about that. You know, when I came back, I was immediately helped by people like Mark Turner and James Boyd. They managed to put together some suggestions of sailing I could do. And so immediately I went and did the course de Falaise, a double-handed Figaro event, and then I did the Jacques Vabre with Josh Hall on Gartmoor in 99. So yeah, I mean having Robin like that was a huge step up, but there was a lot of other people straight afterwards that were there ready to, you know, help and assist, and that was the time, obviously 99-2000, when Ellen MacArthur did such an amazing job with Kingfisher. So you know, there was obviously Robin, there's the backstop of inspiration, I guess, and then suddenly there was someone like Ellen doing what she was doing that suddenly made it more accessible, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say she must have paved the way a little bit and just raised the profile of around the world racing, especially in the UK, because you know she was a phenomenon at that point. We had Ed Gorman on the podcast on the last episode, and he was obviously heavily involved with Ellen's career and writing about it. So I guess that would have made life a little bit easier for you in terms of the feasibility of raising the money to do these sort of events?
Well, certainly in the UK it helped, you know, helped the profile immensely. And before Ellen, obviously there were, you know, obviously there was Mike Golding was there, and then we had the very famous British sailor Tony Bullimore, obviously. Mm-hmm. And Pete Goss, you know, let's not forget him. So you know, the exposure to single-handed offshore racing was increasing, I guess. At that time, obviously, Robin paved the way. So yeah, definitely all those people, you know, give you a bit of inspiration, allow you to see that it is accessible. But, you know, in the accessibility, I guess, in the UK didn't really have so much to do with it, given that, you know, our sponsorship came from Germany in the end.
Yeah, yeah. And the Vendée Globe itself, when did that position itself on your radar? Was that always something you'd wanted to do, or you know, when did that all come along?
Initially, I think before Clipper, there wasn't really, you know, it wasn't an option. It wasn't really accessible, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't feel like an option. It was only until, you know, say a quarter or halfway around Clipper that suddenly I thought that maybe these things were possible to someone like me.
Yeah. What did you feel was stopping you at that point?
I don't know if you feel like there's something stopping you. You just don't realize that it's a possibility.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel like it was, you know, that you could even wish to want to compete in it. That's how far away it was.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the key players in your career is Sir Keith Mills. Tell us how you met Keith and how that relationship kind of blossomed.
Yeah, so Keith was on the Clipper race. So our Clipper race was a very different route than it is today. We started in Plymouth, then on to Madeira, then to San Salvador in the Bahamas, Nassau, Cuba, Panama, Galapagos, Hawaii, then up to Yokohama, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, a little stop in Indonesia, Seychelles, Durban, Cape Town, Salvador, da Bahia in Brazil, Azores, and home.
Wow.
So it was a pretty amazing journey. And Keith joined in Seychelles, so Seychelles to Durban, Durban to Cape Town, and Cape Town to Brazil. And we won the race in Cape Town. So we won a few stops before the finish. So he was obviously there for that. And, you know, I remember him turning up in Seychelles and keen as mustard to, you know, get stuck in and do as many of the jobs as he possibly could. He didn't mind working very hard. I remember he wasn't so good at doing the mother watch, doing the cooking and the cleaning, but worked well under direction, shall we say. But yeah, he was notable really because he was just somebody who turned up and wanted to, you know, pull his weight in whichever way he possibly could.
And that was the beginning of a relationship between the two of you, because the way I perceive this is that he saw something in you that he could help develop, and he could help you with your aspirations as a round the world racer.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty amazing, really. I was after the race, I was a couple of years starting and running a yacht sailing business called Formula One Sailing. And I went to see Keith in London, and we had lunch, and he said, you know what, Alex, we talked about on that Clipper race that you might do the Vendée Globe. He said, are you ever going to do that? And I said, oh, I don't know, Keith. I said, you know, this business is going well now, and yeah, it's a bit hard to see where that fits in at the moment. And anyway, I went home, and the next day I arrived in the post was a little plastic plaque. And at the top of it, the capital letters, it said risk. And underneath it, it said something like, to discover new oceans, at first you must leave sight of the shore. So I describe it as the most subtle kick up the arse I've ever had. Anyway, so I gave him a call, and he said, look, come and see me again. So I went up to see him again. He said, listen, he said, I think you're the right kind of character to take on this kind of challenge. He said, so if you're interested, he said, what I think we could do is we could start a business together, and I can provide it with the funding that will give you all the tools that you need, and here comes the important bit, to make a sustainable business out of this.
Mm.
So that was the starting point. And it was, yes, to try and go and win the Vendée, but it was also to make a sustainable business. And so... Yeah, Keith and I, I started writing business plans, and we started talking to people about renting boats and chartering boats. And at one point, a couple of weeks later, he said to me, listen, Alex, he said, I think we've been going about this the wrong way. He said, I don't think we should rent a boat. He said, I think we should buy a boat. You can just imagine me going, wow, well, what a great idea. Well, why didn't I think of that? And 2 weeks later, we flew from Shoreham Airport to Brest. And he bought a boat for my company for 1.1 million euros. And I tell you, I left my chin in Brest.
Yeah.
It was quite staggering. And even more so, you know, I think we got to another, maybe even a year down the line now. So we're into 2004, kind of July, August time. And I said to Keith, I said, listen, mate, you know, we've had someone who wants to buy the boat. And if we sell the boat now, you know, then this isn't going to cost you too, and it's going to cost you a few hundred thousand. I said, but if we don't sell the boat now and we don't find the sponsorship to compete in the Vendée, I said, this is going to cost you more than a million. And he put his arm around me and he said, do you know what, Alex? He said, if I couldn't afford to lose a million quid, I wouldn't be doing this.
Wow.
And it was a couple of years, a couple of months later, weeks later, actually, it happened very quickly after that. We found Hugo Boss and off we went. And I think part of the, you know, why we've worked with our partners in the ways that we have are because, you know, it costs such an enormous amount of time and money to get a sponsor, to get a partner, that we figured it was just an awful lot easier to keep them, in which case we had to make sure we delivered on everything they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously I want to talk to you about that relationship with Hugo Boss, because I think everybody has an opinion on it from the outside. Everybody marvels at the length of that relationship. It was 19 years, I think, if I've got that right. That's incredible in sports, never mind in sailing. I mean, it's just an incredible relationship. What gave it such legs?
Oh, I think for me, it was the grounding that we had, you know, to to start from the point of such a low point, you know, of taking so long and so much money to get to the point of having a sponsor that our whole purpose was to drive value for them. Everything else was secondary. So I think that that was that starting point, you know, was allowed us to continue to grow. If it had been easy, you know, we probably would have had a different way, a different attitude towards, you know, value generation.
Are you looking for a way to improve your regatta results? Well, the Road to Gold Sail Faster Kit could be just what you need. Created by Hamish Wilcox, the world-class Olympic coach behind Peter Burling and Blair Tuke's Olympic successes, the Road to Gold Sail Faster Kit includes a priority checklist to help you determine the areas that will get you the results you want on the race course, a process prompt sheet with 60 training ideas to make sure you're not missing any piece of the puzzle, and a training planner that effectively breaks down your year to give you the best chance of achieving your racing goals. To find out more, go to www.go.roadtogold.net/yachtracinglife.
And maybe if you'd have won the race the first time around, that might have been job done.
Well, I think I was a long way from winning the race the first time round. I don't think I had any understanding of what it was, you know, what was entailing, really. And I remember the first start and everybody start the spectator boats, turn around and go home, and suddenly you're left out there in the middle of the ocean faced with a, you know, 100-day trip around the world. God, I tell you, it felt daunting then, I tell you.
Yeah, it's refreshing to hear you say that, because it's easy to believe that the Vendée skippers like yourself are kind of superhuman, because it boggles the mind of an average person to be able to just even consider taking on that challenge. So it's refreshing to hear you say that it was massively daunting.
I think it just, you know, I think certainly I did, you know, it's easy to say you're going to do it. And then somebody gives you the money to do it. And then you have to do it.
You have to do it.
I remember Keith saying to me the night before the first one day, he said, look, mate, he said, this is just enormous, you know. And he said, I need you to know, Alex, that if you don't want to do this, you don't have to. Okay, you can back out at any stage before the start tomorrow morning, you know, and it's just not going to be a problem. So please don't feel like you have to do it. But of course, at that stage, you're already fully committed. It doesn't matter what happens. I remember Keith, I think it was a couple of fun days later, Keith turning around to me the night before, and he said exactly the same thing. He said, you know, Alex, you know, tomorrow, you know, the start's gonna, you know, happen. And I remember jutting in and saying, no, Keith, I know, you know, you're gonna tell me that I don't need to go. And he said, no. He said, just bring the bloody boat back this time, will you?
Wow. Wow, what a partnership! What an amazing individual to.
I have to say, you know, he is an amazing individual. He's not just him; it's his family as well. His wife Maureen has been incredibly supportive as well. And you know, I don't take it for granted. There are few people like him, but you know, he's done more for me than I could have ever imagined was possible, and he's done it without telling me what to do. You know, he likes to, you know, give his guidance, but you know, he doesn't insist on anything. He's always viewed it as, you know, it's your business, Alex, you know, I'm ready and to support you, but it's up to you to make a go of it. So there aren't many people that would give what he's given, but to then allow it to develop, you know, according to how I wanted. You know, it's amazing. I mean, for not just professional skills that I've learned from Keith, but you know, personal, you know, life skills, you know, on in lots of areas, he's been an absolute diamond for me.
Yeah, that you bring up an interesting point, because without being disrespectful, I feel like as an individual, as a persona, you've changed a lot over the period of your Vendée Globe races. I saw a very different Alex Thompson back in the day to the one we saw in the last race. Is that how you feel, or is that just something that's happened?
I think that's 20 years, Justin.
Yeah.
You know, you start,
yeah, we all change for sure.
I started as a kid. I mean, I was 30 years old, but I remember being so naive, you know, very difficult to understand exactly what was, you know, what the whole race entailed at the time. And yeah, I mean, the sport has a way to humble you, really. You know, so I've had 20 years of humbling, and I definitely think it shows. I mean, obviously, I've matured a lot as I got older. You know, and I understand a lot more, certainly technically, because I was pretty green at the beginning. And mm-hmm. that understanding of the technical side, you know, gives you an awful lot of confidence. And, you know, I guess, you know, I am probably the most experienced Imoca skipper today. So you know, I think it should show. Eh? You should see a difference.
Yeah. One thing you're known for now is your amazing ability to communicate what it's like to be on the boat to the rest of us. And I think in you know, the last two races, you've done a really, really good job of that. Is that something you enjoy doing, or is it a task?
Oh, no, I mean, for me, the first and foremost, I've always felt like I'm an ambassador for our sport. You know, that trumps everything, really. And, you know, trying to, I guess for us, we've always had to work hard to make this work internationally for Hugo Boss, and so that I guess drove, you know, this desire to tell everybody, and then obviously you see how great it is and how big the, you know, the potential audience is for Imoca and for the Vendée, and so we've always loved it. I've loved it, and I say we because it's my team really, and me. You know, I have to do the bits on the boat and everything, but they're the ones who make it work. And we've always viewed that audience part of it as part of the race. So you've got the race to go and win the race technically and, you know, be first across the line. And the other race is to capture the biggest audience you can and tell as many people. And by doing it like that, then it's, you know, it's fun and it's interactive. So, you know, when I'm doing stuff on the boat, I know what people are saying and the feedback they're giving, and that's inspiring me. And therefore, I'm able to make more great content that inspires other people, and it kind of becomes a virtuous circle. And it's once you get that feedback and everything right, then it's very enjoyable.
So some of the most compelling content, from my point of view, unfortunately for you, was the repairs that you were making in that last race, and. You know, I found that absolutely fascinating, and I know a lot of people that I spoke to and who read some of the stuff that I write said exactly the same thing. Non sailors, they just thought it was amazing that, you know, that the amount of spares that you carried to be able to make those repairs, but also the kind of ingenuity of it all that the team had come up with.
Yeah, that's the important bit, the team. You know, to be perfectly honest, Justin, I didn't really know we had that many bits of carbon on board the boat. You know, obviously I signed it all off, but, you know, to see all those great big U channels and, you know, that's down to Pete Hobson and the team. He decided what we needed. And then in terms of the repairs part, the only bit I have to do is, you know, look, be relatively happy and follow the instructions. That's kind of what I view it. And it's them that they have to write. You should see the detailed instructions that come through, and I come back with a little comment, and 5 minutes later it comes back all rewritten. And, you know, it's not if you're able to follow instructions, and then the bit that's hardest really is to stay positive throughout that.
Yes.
And for me, that's just a change of mindset. You know, just to say, okay, now I was trying to win the race, and now all I'm going to try to do is fix this boat. And then if I know I'm making progress towards fixing the boat, you know, I can be happy. And just by change, it's just a mindset, an expectation change. You know, if you're able to change what your expectation is, then you can pretty much deal with anything, I think.
And you were getting the feedback from social media fed through to you at that point. Is that true?
Yeah, I've always managed to get the feedback from social media. Of what we're doing, as I said, I find it all that part of it inspires me really to keep working. It's always it's a great way to see what people are thinking and reacting to what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, what other sport could we do this? You know, what other sport could you have such a close relationship with the protagonists in the sport as they're actually doing the sport?
Yeah, well, exactly. There isn't any. And I think that's where the big advantage of this area of the sport has got. You know, it has the ability. It already is captivating people. It's inspiring people. You know, people's lives are actually different, are actually better because they're following this race and they're getting something from it. That doesn't happen in other sports. And, you know, the length of time and, you know, the values around it, the lack of ego, because nature's got a way of kicking the ego out of any skipper. It's got more than any sport I know, Justin. I feel massively proud and excited for the future, actually.
Yeah, well, that's good. Listen, I want to ask you, I don't want to go away from the Hugo Boss sponsorship without asking you about the stunts, because they've created a lot of discussion. There's been some criticism, I think, it's fair to say, over the years that, you know, they are stunts and it's got nothing to do with sailing. I love them personally. I thought they were great. I thought they were innovative and completely out of left field. And the fact that you were the one doing the actual stunts made it all the better. Where did the idea come from for all of that? Was that you, or was that Hugo Boss, or?
Hi everyone, Justin Chisholm here. I hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. We'll get back to the interview very quickly, but I just wanted to let you know about Cup Insider, my new America's Cup newsletter and website that's dedicated exclusively to coverage of the 37th America's Cup. If you're an America's Cup fan, check it out now at cupinsider.com.
Back when we did the first one, the Keel Walk, it was, you know, the start of you know, videos and stuff going on YouTube. And I remember Boss did a trick shot video with Martin Keimer, and I remember it getting 50,000 views or something. And then I sat down with my team and said, "Listen, we gotta think of an idea, and then we gotta get more than 50,000 views, and then we can be more important than golfers." The idea to stand on the keel came up, and it actually took a long time to learn how to get that keel out in the water and keep it there. And then obviously we filmed it, and it was a bit of a shock to everybody, really, because I think we put it on YouTube and it was 1 million views in a week. Boston, you can imagine. Yeah, yes, this is good, Alex, yes. And then, you know, from there it kind of developed. And at that time, Hugo Boss was transitioning from being a largely wholesale business to becoming retail. So the task really for in their sports department was to reach outside of these you know, the sports, particularly, you know, sailing is niche. So really that was a way to promote the brand outside of just pure sailing. And yeah, I think of the, you mentioned the calls, you know, the call from me to Hugo Boss, because they are my ideas, and you imagine them saying, "Hi guys, so yeah, I've got this idea. What I'm thinking is we could sail along, and we could lean the boat over, and I could run up the sail in my suit and dive off the top of the 30-meter mast into the water. You know, what do you think?" You know, and I think back then, thinking, "Crikey, they were mad to even let us do it." You know,
yeah.
But I guess that shows the depth and the trust within the relationship, because, you know, there was none of that. They were like, "Yes, Alex, sounds good. Yes, you go." So we cracked on, and obviously the mast walk was the second one. And that was pretty scary for me, I can tell you. I'm not very good with heights, and clearly I can't dive. And then obviously the last one was the skywalk. It was kite surfing is my hobby, so that was a real pleasure to pull off. But again, we didn't know that was possible. We went and did some training about 4 months ago beforehand, just to prove conceptually that it could work. So yeah, that, I think the main bit back for me was the fact that the people at Hugo Boss thought it was a good idea and trusted us enough to go and pull it off.
Yeah, and your relationship, the team's relationship with Hugo Boss, did it just sit within kind of the marketing department, or did it go up as high as CEOs and CMOs?
I mean, it was run mainly by the sports sponsoring department, but there was a lot of access to the senior management, including the CEOs. And yeah, the first CEO was Dr. Bruno Salzer, and that was way back. I think he left in 2007, 2008, and there was Klaus Dietrich Lars after that. who really changed the company immensely, massively changed the company. So I think you know, the fact that we were working so hard and clearly working on their side as our priority, you know, I think that's where, you know, we built up, you know, a lot of trust. We obviously, with our sailing around the world, we'd meet the people in all different countries, from, you know, Australia to Shanghai to Mexico. So we built up a big network within their company of great friends and great supporters who, again, you know, looked at us and they knew that we were working for them. That was our job, was to make their lives easier. And I think that was how we ended up with building such a strong relationship.
Yeah, I've always believed with sponsorship and sailing, it's so important to understand what the company is trying to achieve and how you can, I hate the word align, but it is the right word in this situation, how you can align what you're doing with that. Because if you can't, then there is no relationship to be had.
Well, there's certainly no value to be had. Yeah, you need to be able to create the value in the area that the business wants. So whether that be to, you know, to create some nice PR, or is it brand awareness, or, you know, is there an actual, you know, bottom line reason? Are you selling something? Or, you know, there's a millions of different business cases for it. But if your business case isn't the right one, it just won't work, and it won't stand the test of time.
Yeah, I think people also perceive sports sponsorships are about winning things. How much with Hugo Boss was it based around winning the Vendée Globe, and how much of it was about being associated with the adventure of trying to win it?
Oh, probably at the beginning it was. I mean, it's always been winning, Justin. You know, we're a sports team and we want to be number one, and, you know, it hurts that we haven't managed to get to that point. So, you know, I'd be lying to say it wasn't a big part of it. You know, being successful, and, you know, that's part of the Hugo Boss mindset. But I think as you know, the years went by and more Vendées went past, you know, they really started to understand what the French public already know. You know, it's a story of adventure, of human endeavor, you know, and the content, the amount of stories that are provided or coming out of it are enormous. And the feedback I always had as a brand ambassador was that, you know, I was much more accessible, I think, than other sports people in other fields, and obviously I genuinely always had a passion about it and was able to communicate well about it. So been a fantastic relationship, and the relationship's still there, and I will always feel close to the brand.
Yeah, and just to kind of clarify the situation, because I've heard people say, oh yeah, the Hugo Boss, you know, they've pulled out of the sponsorship, that's why Alex is not going again. But it's the other way around, isn't it, really, that, you know, you, as you told me at the beginning of the podcast, your decision to commit some more time to your family is what's caused this announcement.
Yeah, absolutely. And we spoke to Hugo Boss at the beginning of the year, and they were pretty surprised by my decision. So it's 18 or 19 years coming to an end at the end of this year. And I think it's important to say as well, Justin, that Hugo Boss are now on a different strategy from what they were before. They've got a new CEO joined middle of this year, who's got a very exciting strategy, very different to what we've seen over the last 18, 20 years. And so even if I had decided I wanted to go again, I'm not sure that we would fit into that strategy.
Yeah.
So I don't know, even if I had wanted to go again, whether they would have allowed me. But suffice to say, they today have been amazingly loyal. They've really, you know, they've made me to a degree what I am. You know, we've really, they I feel like they've enabled me to tell this amazing story around the world and build the global fan base of sailing and offshore sailing. And, you know, they've for me, they've built my brand, essentially allowed me to build my brand and go on. We've kind of been on this big journey together, and we've evolved, you know, as they've evolved, I've evolved, Justin.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point and well made. I want to talk to you about the boat that you built for the last race. I never saw it in person, but I pored over all of the videos and I pored over all of the photos that you released just before it was launched, and it was a pretty remarkable boat, wasn't it? Was it your favourite of all the boats?
Oh, they always are, I think, Justin. You know, the number one overcome by number two, and this is number seven, this one.
Yeah. Yeah, so tell us something about the what made that boat so different. I guess the obvious thing is that, you know, the fact that you raced it from inside to a large degree.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that most people see the big difference. For me, the big difference probably was obviously the cockpit being inside. The foil package was quite different, and very different from the previous generation. So yeah, they were the main differences, and that was driven by probably me knowing that this was going to be my last boat for a while. So, you know, wanting to be able to push, you know, harder in a direction than we probably thought we would have done before. And I think the bit that people probably don't, I'm not sure how people know we run these things, but for us, we run our own team. We finance our own team. We borrow the money to build the boat. So we own the boat. The team owns the boat. And so when you're going and designing and building one of these, you're very aware that if you go left field too hard and you end up producing a boat that is not very good or perceived to not be very good, then you can't sell it. And yeah, then if you can't sell it, your whole business model falls apart. So it's really hard to take a big gamble for everybody because it's, you know, you can't recover from it. And if you're an independent team, you know, potentially it kills your business. So yeah, it was a big move to do it. And the inside cockpit, really, if you were to drill down into the detail of it, of what the advantages of it are, you get to a point where you're just like, this is a no-brainer. You know, it's not, it becomes a fairly easy decision to make.
Yeah, just because the boats are now so extreme in terms of performance that you need to be inside.
No, actually. The biggest, the single biggest benefit, of apart from the human being more human overall, is that one of the rules we have is when the boat's upside down, you have to be able to self-right. So when you're upside down, the keel counts to the side, and then the boat will pop back up. And by having volume in your coach roof in the place where there used to be a hole and a cockpit, means it's an awful lot easier for the boat to come back upright again with the keel, which means you can have less weight on the keel.
Right.
So actually, you end up with a significantly lighter boat because of that volume at the back there.
Wow.
Plus, the boat was obviously drawn by VPLP, but the biggest hand in that was Peter Hobson in our team. And, you know, he was... But everything on the boat has a second or even third use. So the sides of the cockpit that are inside there, right, kind of on top and behind the keel there, are actually is actually the structure for the keel.
Right.
So the sides of the cockpit become free because they've got a double use. So there was a lot of advantages, but the main one there was the weight from when you're upside down.
Yeah, which means you can have a lighter boat.
Which means you can have a lighter boat, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the first time I've heard that, Alex, so thank you for that. I guess the obvious question about that boat was it, you know, you did end up making repairs to it. What, I'm sure you've done massive debriefs about what went wrong with that whole thing. Was it design? Was it construction? What was the problem?
In the bow area, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me in the bow area, to me it was clearly design. Engineering.
Yeah.
And I think a few of us within the team feel a little bit misled in that department.
Right. Right. It's, yeah. By the designers of the boat, or
more by the engineers.
Right. Okay.
And you know, there's you know, we've all got a part to play in these things. You know, part of our job as a team is, you know, we have to work with third party suppliers. It's, you know, we're not big enough you know, to take it all in house. And so, you know, it's finding the right way to work with those suppliers and making sure you get the detail right. And ultimately, you can only point the finger at yourself in the end, Justin, because you have to have the processes in place to make sure you capture the detail in the right way. And you have to make sure that the right questions are being asked. And anyway, you know, I think what we take positively out of this is that we'll put in place a process to stop that kind of thing from ever happening again.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say that everything is a lesson learned, whether it's a positive or a negative that you're dealing with, for sure.
Well, if you're learning a lesson, to me, it doesn't matter how negative it is. You know, ultimately, it becomes positive.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, there's every single thing that's ever happened to me out there in the ocean, and everything has happened, you know, apart from, you know, when we hit the mammal in the Jacques Vabre in 19, probably almost every single one of them, you know, if you're brutally honest, you know, you point the finger and there'll be a little chain of it. And ultimately it comes down to the person at the top of the team, and that's me.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and you just have to be brutally honest about them and make sure each time, you know, you learn and you get better and you get stronger, and make sure you never make the same mistake twice.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, some of those mistakes have been in the full, well, most of them have been in the full glare of the public eye. And it's not easy to deal with. And, you know, your comment now reminds me of how open and honest you were about, you know, running aground in the Caribbean in a race that you looked certain to win. But you fronted up to the cameras and told the story. Is that something you kind of look back on with a bit of pride?
Well, hitting Guadeloupe?
No, not hitting the not hitting the bricks, but the way you dealt with that afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it a bit, Justin, and it comes, you know, if you look at the truth of that scenario. So, you know, obviously, yeah, I was going to win that race. There was no doubt about it. And then I go to sleep, and next thing I wake up and I'm on the rocks. And then I obviously just had to, in a blind panic, get the boat off the rocks. And then, you know, if I'm totally honest, I just wanted to sail to Antigua and dig a big hole and die and, you know, get into that hole, hide myself. But instead I had to sail around the island, which was awfully humiliating, I have to say. And then I arrived. I remember everyone screaming. They wanted me to go on the front of the boat and, you know, start cheering at what a great job I'd done. And obviously I knew that I'd not done a very good job at the end. So I couldn't do that. And then I crossed the finish line and then within like 10 seconds, the jury were on the boat, and the jury said, you know, one of them said pretty much straight away, or, you know, that you've got a 24 hour penalty. I think we were expecting somewhere in the region of 4 hours, not 24. Yeah. So it was a shock. And then one of the jury said something like, well, we couldn't have you winning the race, could we, Alex? Which I didn't find terribly good. But then 5 minutes later, I'm parked on the pontoon. So yeah. There was no planning or thinking about what I was going to say or not say. Everything that I said on that just came from somewhere within me. And I think that comes a little bit from, you know, growing up and being fairly instilled in me early on that, you know, I had to, you have to stand up and be counted. That was certainly something from my dad was, you know, when you mess it up, you got to stand up and hold your hands up and take what you should be taking.
So what happens next is a move, it seems to me, towards mentoring maybe a younger skipper for the next Fondé Globe. Just the story you've just told makes you look like somebody that would be really good at mentoring that, because you've got this vast array of experience of success and of struggling with the pain of failure. Do you see yourself as somebody who could be a good mentor? I mean, I guess obviously you do.
I think I've got a lot I can impart to somebody else, but, you know, I think more importantly, it's, you know, what we've created, the team that we've created. You know, in some way you could look at it as it's a great big kind of Alex management tool management and development tool. And I think the biggest the hardest thing for me was seeing this all stop. You know, the amount of knowledge and understanding and, you know, what everything we've created over the time is there and it's ready to go and get better. And I think for me, it would be awful if somebody didn't take advantage of, you know, all the money that's been spent, all the knowledge that's been created. As for me as a mentor, you know, I think I would fit in. I think I'd do a really good job, actually, Justin, as a mentor. My starting point was being first mate for Sir Robin Knox-Johnson on our expedition to Greenland. And I love playing that supporting role. And I think I'd be very happy to do it in whichever way anybody, you know, thinks I can provide the benefit. To me, the important part is that when you're a skipper in one of these races, you've got to be the man or the woman at the top. You got to be the person making the choices. Because if I think back and think that somebody made me sail around the world on a boat that had some stuff on there I didn't agree with, I would find that really, really difficult. So for me, the starting point has to be that the new skipper has to be the leader that we all look to, that we all, you know, see in them that they want to win, and that inspires us to give everything we've got and fully commit to go and win ourselves.
So is the idea to provide a kind of incubator for potential Vendée Globe competitors?
I think the starting point for us is to put together the partners, the right reasons, and find the right sponsors to be able to move forwards to start building a boat and challenge for the next race. I think the skipper can and should come after that, really, because that, depending on what the partner wants or the partners want, will depend on who that skipper is.
Interesting. Yeah. Because I've heard you say that you either do it one way or the other. You either start with a skipper and then find a sponsor that matches them, or you start with a sponsor and then, as you say, slot the skipper in. So I guess there are two approaches to it.
Yeah, you just want to, I think, be, you know, mindful that you don't want to promise the earth to a skipper and then get halfway down the line and realize that skipper's not matching very well with the partners. So I think we're doing it the right way around. I mean, our DNA is British. You know, it'd be great if we could continue with a British skipper. That would be great. I mean, I'm a huge admirer of Sam Davis, by the way. I can't wait to see her on that start line with a brand new boat.
Finally.
I know. Yeah, she could really do it. She really could. And then obviously we've got Sam Goodchild, who's doing the TJV right now, but also Alan Roberts. You know, I'm big admirers of those people. But, you know, it may well be a skipper that could be international outside of UK and outside of France. But it's at the moment looking at all the options and just want to finalise the funding route and then we'll choose a skipper.
Sam Goodchild will be a great story, because the year I met Sam was in Le Sable d'Olonne, and I think he just finished working as a preparateur with you. So that will be a nice circle of activity, yeah, isn't it?
In 2007, he did his first transatlantic with us. We were sailing, I think we had the old Asser Abloy, which was a corporate boat for us. And right. We sailed her to New York, and then she went on a truck to Richmond, and onto Toronto, and then ultimately was trucked across America. But Sam Goodchild did that first transatlantic with us, with Ross on board the boat, and we had a few German sponsors on board as well, who I seem to remember were interested in the possibility of a helicopter liftoff mid transatlantic.
I'm sure they were. Well, that remains to be seen how that will all work out. The clock must be ticking though, because if you're going to build a boat for the next Vendée Globe, when would you need to pull the trigger on that?
Middle of next year, probably. You know, I think that's the day. You can do a lot of things to, you know, to sharpen the process and try and cut down time. And I think probably that's where we'll be. Is, you know, we've got a lot of tried and tested systems on board the boat already. And remember, this is our current boat is a development of the last one. So this next one would be number three. And each time you do it, it gets more refined. The process gets better. You make less mistakes. you know, it certainly gets easier, quicker, and cheaper as you understand more about the process.
And you told me at the beginning of the podcast that you're just about to head down and kind of hand the boat over to its new owner. Now, I feel like I did see who'd bought the boat, and it's gone completely out of my head, or perhaps I didn't. Perhaps it's still a secret.
It's Alan Rohrer.
That's right. Who is
a Swiss sailor. He's 28, I think he is. He's done two Vendées already, which, so he's two ahead of me when I started already. And we've done a fair bit of sailing together already. And he's a very good sailor. Very, very, very good sailor. I've been very impressed by what he can do. And, you know, I don't get a chance to sail with many Vendée skippers. But, you know, the few that I have, he just sits there with the same level. You know, he's very bright. He's very attentive. And he's a super nice guy. So I'm really happy to see someone who's done the hard yards. You know, he's done a Vendée. He did a Vendée on Pip Hare's boat before Pip Hare had it.
Yeah.
And then the last one, he did it on a boat that was pretty slow and pretty wet. So he deserves his chance. So I'm chuffed for him, really chuffed.
Handing over a boat like that isn't as simple as just kind of dropping the paperwork off, is it? What's the process you've gone through?
No, it'll take many months. You know, the tech and the history of the boat is a bit flabbergasting. So it just takes a while, and it's important for us that we hand it over in the right way and support Alan, you know, as and when we can. There's a bit of our heart is in that boat. You know, our team are terribly proud of it, and you know, we would be extremely happy to see Alan do well on it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this next Vendée Globe, perhaps I shouldn't be asking you about this, given that you're not going to be racing in it, but potentially this is going to be the most exciting yet, right? With so many new boats going to be built and.
Yeah,
so many.
Let's go back to 2007, 2008. There was, I think, 18 new boats built then.
Wow.
We're looking at somewhere in the region of 12 maybe now for this next one. So it's unprecedented, Justin, because of the quality of the people.
Yeah.
You know, you look at who's coming in now. Johan Richman. You look at, obviously, Jeremy Bay will be on another boat. So will Charlie Darlin with a Pevia. You know, Sam Davis is going to have a new one. Boris Herman's having a new one. Yannick Westerhaven's having a new one. You know, it's going to be a very interesting time for the class. And I'd say if, you know, just looking already at the next edition, to me it looks more competitive and harder than it's ever been, which means it's going to be a great spectacle for the audience.
It is. We're all looking forward to that. I'm delighted that you are going to be hopefully involved in it. Not as a sailor, but with the management of another campaign, at least, I'm really pleased for that. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I've really enjoyed it. I'm sure the listeners will too. But for now, I'll just say thanks very much.
No problem, Justin. Great to chat, and take care. Speak soon.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Alex Thompson for taking the time out of his schedule to speak to me, and thanks also to all of you listeners for tuning in around the world. I'll be back soon with another interview from the professional sailing world, and until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.